Okay, back to the straight feet. Here's the straight scoop on the straight feet. Now, many of the commentators we find translate this different than ye old King James Version. They render it as, "and their legs were straight." So now they have it referring not to the feet, but to the legs. And their legs were straight rather than their feet were straight. Feet. And if we translate it that way, then there's two ways we could picture it in our mind, or on paper, whatever you prefer. The first way would be that it's saying that the leg did not protrude in any part, but that it was basically a straight leg, not like the legs of an ox, for example. You know, when you draw a horse or an ox, you have to curve it out like that. The flank coming down, it curves to the joint, what we would be the knee, and then down like that, rather than a man's, which is straight. So this would be saying then it's not a protruding leg like the legs of an ox, but it's a straight leg like a man's. Or some would understand from this translation, and this is the second way to understand it, that these legs are actually like solid pillars. And there's no joints to bend, like a man has joint at the knee to bend his leg. Now, if their legs don't bend, then obviously they don't walk like men walk. They'd have to kind of glide along rather than walking. And you say, no, how could they do that? Remember, this is a symbol. And there are things that are going to be absolutely impossible in the natural for anything, for this contraption to ever get off the ground. It's not going to be those magnificent men in their flying machines, if you ever saw that film, to ever try to get it off the ground if you're looking at it in a literal way to interpret it. So they're gliding along rather than walking. Now the nice thing about this would be, if you've got a solid pillar that doesn't bend at the knee, then it's equally fitted for motion in any direction. A knee, I don't know how many of you have noticed this, but your leg doesn't go sideways quite as well as it goes forward, because you've got a knee that bends, a joint that bends in one direction, your ball and socket joint there in your knee. But it doesn't bend sideways. Many football players find that out when they're running upfield and they cut a little bit too sharp on the AstroTurf and they lose the crucial ligament here on the side of the knee. Now, I believe, though, that the Hebrew is best translated as the King James has it. Here, their feet were straight feet. So I don't think it's talking about their legs. I think it's talking about their feet. Now, what does that mean then, a straight foot? I believe that it's saying that the foot, they did not lay down a flat horizontal sole. Well, that's kind of a big foot, but it's Bigfoot. They did not lay down a flat horizontal sole in their foot like that of a human, but it was more of a straight foot, and some have made it kind of looking like a, you know, like a calf's foot or some kind of an animal's foot that's just a straight foot. Now, the truth in this is that it's speaking of course, the foot is the walk, and the walk is a person's behavior, their manner of life, as they walk before the Lord. And it speaks of uprightness. And so the living ones are representing the saints who are walking in a totally experientially upright manner, with truth, with integrity, in their walk. And of course, that was seen in Jesus, who knew no sin, in whom no guile was found. And it will likewise be found in this body of Christ in the end of time. Did the roll book make it around the second time? You've all signed for A and B then? Okay. Now, he goes on to say, and the sole of their foot, which is the bottom of it, was like the sole of a calf's foot. Now, a calf's foot, again, the sole of it is, you know, it's basically just rounded, and it doesn't have long protruding toes on one side or another like we do, which makes it nice to walk one way. The toes bend as you go forward, and you can go backward kind of, but to go onto the side, you can't really go directly sideways with it easily. And so this round, solid foot, again, I think the point is capable of moving any direction now without having, what do we have to do? We turn around. We have to turn our whole body around. And then we go a certain direction. Of course, that's where the Lord gets the idea of being converted. You'd be turned from one direction going to another. But in this case, any direction the Lord would call them, see, four faces, north, south, east, west, or any point in between, their foot is already, in a sense, headed that direction, being a round foot, and they can go easily. Now, Don feels that they traveled only when they were in the air. And so that in his opinion, you don't necessarily have to imagine them even moving on the ground and gliding along on these rather strange-looking legs and feet, but that they moved in the air to wherever they were going, and then they just settled down, as far as what Ezekiel would see, perhaps. But that doesn't negate any of the truths, because they must have had feet for some kind of a reason and legs. So it's still, all the typology, I believe, would fit, nevertheless. Yes?
Are those a calf or a cloven hoof?
Pardon?
A calf is a cloven hoof.
True, but it does not have the big toes sticking out like we do, and it's still more of a rounded. Granted, any animal, any of the four-footed mammal species anyway, is, you know, whether it's a calf or a deer or a hart or a gazelle, they're going to have a slight, you know, impression in the front there with the cloven, but it's still, compared to a man's foot, is basically round and solid. Yes?
So sure-footedness,
sure-footedness perhaps could be in there as well. Yeah. Able to walk in difficult places, difficult situations and times, and still keep their stability. Yes? Now, the point that I think I see here then is that, well, let me say one more thing here. I was talking about Don felt that they traveled only when in the air. Also, and we haven't gotten to the wheels yet, but the wheels, he doesn't feel, are for moving or for, you know, for going along the earth, the wheels turning on the earth, but rather they acted as stabilizers, kind of like gyroscopes, so that the wheels were not so much directional or for movement, transportation, but they were for stabilizing of the whole living one, and we'll look at that later. But anyway, I think this is talking about the ability to go in any direction that God commands easily and nimbly. Like we read in Psalms 29:6, it says, using the same type of a metaphor, it says, he maketh them also to skip like a calf. I think the idea of joy is involved in that one as well. But also in Malachi 4:2, it says, they shall grow up as calves of the stall. NES says they shall skip about like calves from the stall. All right? 7b says concerning these feet, and they sparkled like the color of burnished brass. Now, brass, of course, refers to judgment. And their feet sparkle like brass, polished brass. Now, remember, the feet speaks of a person's walk, his life. And it sparkles like brass, and it reflects, it's polished brass, so it reflects the light, typologically speaking, of the fact that Christ died and was judged for all of us. And it's a work that's completed. It's polished brass. It's not rough, dull brass. but it's highly refined. It's a finished work. It's polished. So it's Christ's judgment once and for all. And I think there's a secondary truth in this as well, and that is they're going to be judged. They're going to go. They're going to come through some judgments of God, not like judgments on the ungodly, but they're going to come through much tribulation. They're going to come through fires, and they're going to come out of those fires, like Job said, purified. And in this case, it's brass instead of gold. But I think it's first Christ, and then any trials that the saints may go through. Because in John's picture of Jesus, in Revelation chapter 1 and verse 15, it said his feet were like fine brass. Same truth. His feet were like fine brass. Revelation 1:15. In other words, in his walk, his mission on earth was to take the judgment of God upon him for the sins of man. And now, it's not so much us being judged for the world. Again, this, we're not looking at Catholic theology here. But us reflecting the fact of Christ being judged in our lives, in our walk, the fact that Christ has been judged once for all. And so it's burnished brass in the feet in the walk. Some other tie-in scriptures would be Ezekiel chapter 40 and verse 3, where he sees a man, and the entire man has an appearance as of brass. So it wasn't just Jesus' feet that were brass. Jesus took, he who knew no sin, took, became sin for us. His appearance is of brass. He became a curse for us. Also in Daniel chapter 10 and verse 6, he sees a figure and its arms and its feet were like polished brass. Now, I think there's yet one more point on this feet of brass, and that is it shows the mission that these cherubim are on, and that's their walk, their feet. Shows where they're headed, what they're going to be doing for the Lord. And indeed, it is a mission of judgment. In this particular context, we see that they are bringing God's judgment upon sinful Judah because of their transgressions, their unrepentant heart. All right, number 8. And they had the hands of a man under their wings on their four sides. And they four had their faces and their wings. Now he sees human hands, the hands of a man, under their wings and at the sides of their torsos. Now, the obvious implication is that there were human arms as well, connected to the hands, but the arms are not seen because they're hidden under the wings. Now, the hand speaks of many pretty much related ideas, I believe, in the Bible. The hand is how man does things in action. When you're working and so forth, the hands are almost always involved in action. And therefore, relating it to the spiritual realm, the ministry. The hand speaks of the ministry. Indeed, there's a phrase, almost a technical phrase in the Hebrew, when it's talking about the Levites and the priests ministering, that talks about the hand being filled. Filling of the hand speaks of them being ordained into the ministry. Filling the hand, something to do with the hand. Also can refer to power. Because the power of the back and the shoulders and the arm can be transferred through the hand. And it can speak of ability, having ability. We even talk about somebody who's handy. He's handy, a handyman. He's good with his hands. Also can refer to the idea of dexterity. If you've ever seen fine craftsmen, jewelers, sculptors, artisans, who are very dexterous with their hands. And so this is what is going to be seen, God's power, his ability, his dexterity, through the ministry, through the hands of this group. And of course, it's according to the Spirit that led them. They just didn't do whatever they wanted to do with their hands. It was according to the Spirit that led them and under the Christ that was over them. Now, there's a little bit of a vagary here in the construction, where it says they had the hands of a man under their wings. And that is that the Hebrew may be meaning that each of the creatures had four hands, or that the hands of a man were upon the sides of the four of them. Because notice the number four there, on their four sides. Well, that's one way to render it. But if you render it, change it around a little bit, render it another way, we're talking about four hands. For each of them, you say, oh, come on now. Well, they have four faces. So it wouldn't be all that unusual to have a hand for each face, an action for each manifestation, for each attribute. That's a possibility. Or it could be like the King James is indicating, that they had the hands of the man of a man on the sides of the four of them. In other words, as they stood in this square, again, you might want to make reference to your drawing, at their sides, as they stood in this square, they had hands at their sides, which would indicate two hands each instead of four hands each. And I think that's probably how it's been drawn here for you, hasn't it, with two hands each instead of four? I don't have mine out here, but... Pardon? Doesn't really show. You can't see the other sides, is probably the problem. Yeah, it doesn't even show the hands. The hands are supposed to be seen, at least the impression of them, the form of them underneath the wings, and either they omitted that particular point or it was a little bit hard for them to render it, but anyway, it could be two or four each. Now notice the hands were under their wings. So you didn't see a big, huge arm bulging, hanging by their side, you know, naked power there, and the hand just hanging out there. But it was seen under the wing. And I believe that that's telling us something about the source of our power. The source of our power is hidden. Because the source of our power and our dexterity, our ability, our ministry is God, who is invisible spirit. And so the wings represent the wings of the spirit that lift us up into the heavenlies. As we pray and as we soar like the eagle with God, his spirit will do the work. As we are moved by the wings of the spirit. We see, for an example, in chapter 10, verses 5 through 7, that these hands don't even move until God commands them to. And when he tells them, they move. But he tells us, interestingly enough, in the next verse, in chapter 10, verse 8, that the shape of a man's hand was seen under the wings. And that's why I've been talking about the hands under the wings, seen under the wings. It says that he saw the shape of a man's hand under the wings, which means it must have been kind of a thin wing that draped and conformed so closely to the side of the body that the bulge of a hand underneath it could be seen, just like a hand under a coat or a garment could be seen. And why does God do that? Why does he tell us that little detail? Because God is telling us that he doesn't work without man. He doesn't work aside from man. He works with man. He works through man. Let us, he tells all the saints, through Christ, make man in our image after our likeness. So he's not really lifting man up, and he's not shoving his face into the dirt. You see the hand? Okay, there's a man there, but it's under the Spirit. He's under the power of God. It's the power of God. He's hiding, as it were, his humanity. The point isn't the earthen vessel, but it's the Spirit of God working and moving. And then in verse 8b, you just have a summary of what has just been said. And he does that, I believe, in some other places here. He just kind of goes back over what he said. Nothing, no new information brought, as far as I can tell. He just says, and they four had their faces and their wings. Verse 9. Now he's going to follow with verse 9 and following here with a more detailed description of what we've already seen. He's already mentioned that they have hands and wings and so forth, but now he shows them in detail. And their wings were joined one to another. They turned not when they went. They went every one straight forward. Now, their wings are joined. However, this is going to be shown to us in verse 11 by referring only to the two upper wings of each cherub. Remember, each cherub has four wings. The two lower wings are, we already saw, at their sides. And so it's the two upper wings, in other words, two wings that are spread out for flying, that are being joined here in verse 8. And verse 11 shows us that. It says there are two wings of everyone were joined to one another, and two covered their bodies. So, the two upper wings, and you'll see this in your chart now, in your drawing, the two upper wings that are in motion, they're touching at the four corners of this palanquin. And then the two that are down are covering their sides and their hands. Now, again, you know, it would be impossible for any birds to fly and have their wings touching, wouldn't it, because of the motion. But it's not impossible to have it in the andite type, to have unity in the ministry. That's all this is talking about. As we move for the Lord, as we're in motion for Him, we're not bumping into one another like bull in a china shop. There's unity in motion for the Lord, unity in flying. So the outstretched right wing of one cherub was joined at its tip to the outstretched left wing of his neighbor. Harmony and unity of the four working together as one. Now this applies only when in motion, because when they stood, then these upper wings were let down as well, as we see in verse 24. B, when they stood, they let down their wings. So these other upper two wings were let down when they stood, and then they wouldn't be touching anymore. You might say, well, what's the application there? How come they're no longer in unity? Well, it's not saying they're in disunity, but it may be implying that the unity is not quite the same. Maybe you've noticed this. The times when you're the closest to another person in the body of Christ is when you're in motion in the Spirit. In a prayer meeting, dancing before the Lord, under the anointing of God, somehow your wings are up and you're in motion in the Spirit, and that's when you're locked. The tightest with somebody else in the body of Christ. When you let your wings down and you're just kind of around, it's not the same. It's not the same. So when we're all moving for God, the Spirit unites us as one. Our oneness is in the Spirit of God, is what that's telling us. It's not in ourselves. Our backgrounds are so different. We're so different and unique as individuals that we're never going to find a unity based on what game you like to play, you know, or whatever, what hobbies you have, or, you know, where you like to go out for dinner. I mean, the unity is going to be in the Spirit of God. That's where the unity is, not in ourselves. Paul said we have all been made to drink of that same Spirit. 1 Corinthians chapter 12. And verse 13, and of course you know the famous refrain in Ephesians 4:3, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit, not the unity of the flesh. We're never going to have a unity of the flesh. In fact, we're not supposed to be walking according to the lower nature. That's supposed to be mortified, and we're supposed to walk in the Spirit. And we're supposed to keep that unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace until we come to the unity of the faith. Okay, and then it goes on to say, in verse 9, they turned not when they went. They went, every one straight forward. Now, it's talking about the living ones themselves here, not their wings. And it's saying that when these living ones were in motion, they didn't have to turn to go one way. Again, like we do as one single solitary individual. Someone says, hey, over here. We hear their voice behind us. We turn to look to see who's talking to us, and then we walk in that direction. Well, they don't have to do that because they've got four faces. So they're always looking some direction, all four directions at once, and without turning. So no matter which direction they went, each one of them was already facing it with one of their faces. Each one of the four was already facing all directions at the same time. Now, one of them might not be the leader to that direction, right? It would be the one who was already facing toward the north, looking out from you to the north, maybe. He would be the one that would be first among the quartet there. But still, his brothers on his left and right and behind him, they all have a face for that direction, too. They're willing to go that direction, too. And they don't have to turn to do it. In other words, okay. If we have to go this direction, it's not that way. They're ready to go. That's instant in season and out of season. In fact, I think there's a number of points that are shown here. And now, this may beg the question in your mind, which face was facing which direction, though, as far as when you would look at them? And if you look on our chart, you'll see that this artist's conception shows the man's face facing outward on all of the sides. So if you walked around this four-sided being, the one face that would be facing outward on each out from each side would be the man's face. And then the one that would be on the left would be the ox's. I believe that's the ox. The one on the right is the lion. And then the one facing in toward the center, inside of the living one, would be the eagle. That's one way to diagram it. Another way is to have all of the men's faces facing the same direction instead of all facing out. And that would change. It's probably going to be one or the other. I don't think it would be that. There is another alternative. That's the same alternative. That would have one different face on each of the four sides than right. I'll put this on the board a little bit later, too. But Don feels that the man's faces were all facing the same direction. And I haven't been able to figure out exactly what he meant by that. If he meant that they were all facing north, for example, so that if you looked on the side, you wouldn't see a man's face looking out. You'd be seeing a look north where the other one is. Or if he meant they're all looking out. Based upon this handout, which I'm sure he either drew or had drawn, I must interpret his remarks to mean man's face was always facing outward. So that if you were around looking at this cherubim from any angle, the first face that you would see would be that of a man. That's probably the best interpretation, because Ezekiel said their appearance was as the appearance of a man. So that's the face that you see looking right at you from any side of the cherubim. Yes?
Does it also mean then that as this object came towards the person, you would see one face of a man, one face of an eagle, explaining that happened facing in, one face of an ox, one face of a lion?
Well, assuming he could see through it all the way to the backside looking at him, and assuming he could see from the sides, yes. He'd see one of all four, but the first one would always be the man, because that would be the one that's facing out. Mm-hmm. Now, here's what I feel is shown by this, that they turned not when they went, and everyone went straight forward. Notice, not by a devious, curving route, but straight forward. Number one, it's showing resolution. These living ones are resolute in their purpose. Remember how it said Jesus set his face for Jerusalem? This shows that not changing their course, not indecisive. Well, should we or shouldn't we? Well, can I or can't I? These are unflinching, unchanging, resolute in their purpose. See, that's what God is going to build within us. We're not going to be wishy-washy about the things of God. We're going to be resolute because we're going to know and we're going to be committed. Number two, I believe it shows accuracy, because it says they went straight forward, and I'm assuming it means straight forward wherever God wanted them to go. And so accuracy, they went in a, you know the old saying, the shortest distance between two points is a straight line, not a curved line, not a zigzag line, a straight line. So it's accuracy, accomplishing God's will without mistakes, without turning around, without stopping and then starting again, but just going straight ahead to accomplish it. In other words, no hamartia, as the Greek has, no missing the mark. Number three, I believe it speaks of full knowledge and vision as well. Because they didn't have to turn. Why didn't they have to turn? Because they saw all around them at all times. And so it speaks of the knowledge of God and the vision of God through his saints. Now, I'm not implying omniscience on the part of saints, even in heaven. But I'm just saying God's knowledge. Whenever we need it, whatever we need, whatever direction it happened to be, even what's behind us. We can have eyes in the back of our head, spiritually speaking, meaning that the Lord can show us when the devil's trying to sneak up behind us and catch us. We're not ignorant of his devices, Paul said. And he said we're to walk circumspectly. That's our responsibility. And that's the two Latin words there, circum, which means circle, like circumscribe or circumference, and spec, which means to look at, like we say inspect or spectroscope. And so it means to look around you, to be looking around you. And it means, spiritually speaking, be watching what's going on around you. And I believe this is that same truth. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 15. Fourth of all, I believe it speaks of obedience. Because they went straight forward to do God's commands. There was no deviating from the course that God plotted for them. Like Jonah deviated. He went to Nineveh, granted. But he went to Nineveh by way of Joppa, by way of a ship bound for Tarshish, by way of the deep blue sea, by way of some kind of a sea creature, by way of Joppa, and then to Nineveh. That was not exactly a straight line. But by the grace of God, he did make it. So, no deviating. Like it says to the Hebrews, make straight paths for your feet. Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 13. Next of all, I believe it speaks of perfect harmony. In other words, living creature number two didn't have to turn in order for the other living creature number one to go straight. He didn't have to turn for one to go straight. They could all go together in perfect harmony without turning. Like Paul said, joined in the same mind. Again, 1 Corinthians 1:10. That may not be the last time I quote that, even though it's been the second time in this class, because it's unity and harmony is so emphasized in this vision tells us we need to get unified in God. We need to let God do what he wants to do to bring us to that point. And then last of all, versatility. I believe it speaks of versatility in the spirit. Because, face it, it's a lot easier if you're going somewhere to be able to just go straight instead of having to turn. Why? You take a left turn here and you go down, you take a right, then you take a left, then you take another left, then you take a right. But if you can just say, follow this street, stay on this street and go straight on this street for 5 miles, and it's right at the end of the street, you can't miss it. And so if we can go any direction that God sends us with ease, without having to go through a lot of twists and turns and concatenations, then we'll be much more versatile for him. For example, if God was to call somebody, some one of us, to a different full-time ministry somewhere right now, how much turning would we have to do to be ready for it? Or how many of us would be, in a sense, ready to just drop everything and do it? Now, this point will be reiterated throughout the vision of going straight. For example, in verse 12, they went everyone straight forward. Wherever the Spirit was to go, they went. Verse 17, when they went upon their four sides, and they turned not when they went. They didn't turn. Verse 20, whithersoever the Spirit was to go, they went, and thither their spirit was to go. And so wherever the Spirit went, they went. And chapter 10 and verse 11, where it says again, they turned not as they went. Also chapter 10, verse 10:22, everyone went straight forward. For that's an important point with God, or he would not have mentioned it that many times. He wants us to be straight on for him. You know how they call a person a straight arrow in the world? If they're a person that just, they're above board, they're open, they're honest, they're not devious and underhanded and so forth, he says, and plus they're walking in a way that is usually higher morally than the people around them. So, that guy's a straight arrow. As if it's a sin, you know, to be a straight arrow. If I had arrows in my quiver and then my life depended upon them, you better believe I'd want a straight arrow. I would not want forked arrow or crooked arrow. Verse 10. So anyway, God wants us to be resolute, accurate, with his knowledge, obedient, in perfect harmony, and with versatility. A high calling indeed. Verse 10. As for the likeness of their faces, they four had the face of a man and the face of a lion on the right side, and they four had the face of an ox on the left side, and they four also had the face of an eagle. Notice this right side and then the left side, and that would tend to support the feeling that when you looked at it from any one of its sides, that's what you'd see, is the man in the front and the lion on the right and the ox on the left, and the eagle then in the rear. But notice the man's face mentioned first. That's the one that's predominant. That's the one that faced the front as Ezekiel viewed them. And indicating again, this is the saints of God. Now, remember, each cherub had all of these same four faces. So each one of us is going to have the completed work of God in us. He wants to bring us unto a perfect man, a bride without spot. Now, the living creatures in Revelation 4:7 have the same four faces. A man, lion, ox, or maybe it says calf there, and eagle. However, again, I think each cherub only has the one face, one of those four faces in Revelation. Now, let's look at these for a minute. Each one had the face of a man, because man is made in the image of God, created in the image of God. Therefore, I believe this can symbolize that which is of God that is in them. That which is of God which is in us. We have been created in the image of God, and we're being made into his likeness. We are more like God than any of the other creatures in the universe. The creatures were not said to be created in his image. and to be being made into his likeness. Only man. And I think also you see a man here because this is speaking of the last Adam, Jesus Christ, who was a man, and yet he was God as to his deity. So he sees the face of a man. So when they see us, they should see the face of a man. That is, they should see the glory of God, because man is created in the image of God, and they should see a representative of Jesus Christ, a brother, a younger brother of Jesus Christ. Then, on the right side, the face of a lion. Of course, the lion connotes attributes like strength and courage, you know, the fearless lion, jumping on animals much larger than them and so forth. And regal, you know, the lion of the tribe of Judah, that which is kingly or regal. The lion, the attributes of a lion were attributed to David in the Bible, and obviously Jesus, who is called the Lion of the tribe of Judah, because the lion may have been the standard of the tribe of Judah, but also Satan. Because remember, a lion is just, it's an animal, and so the Lord might be trying to draw parallel, certain parallels to Christ, and then certain other parallels, certain other aspects of the lion to the devil. Because he says that he walks about as a lion. Didn't say he was a lion, but he walks about as a lion, seeking whom he may devour. So it's the idea of the devouring and destroying aspect of the lion that is brought out when he represents Satan. When it's Christ, it's more, you know, the king of the beasts, royal, regal, courage. Although, admittedly, there is a destructive aspect there, because it says the Son of God was manifested to destroy the works of the devil. Also, lions are sometimes used as an analogy for vicious men, vicious and wicked men in the Bible. And there are certain ancient nations whose symbol was a lion and who are represented by a lion in the Bible, including Babylon and Assyria. Now, next on the left was an ox. The face of an ox on the left side. When we think of the ox, we think of tremendous strength. To be able to pull that long plow through that hard pan dirt takes tremendous power. And they're patient. They're not quick-tempered like little Chihuahua dogs. You know, you blink at it and the thing bites your head off. And patient. And they can work long and hard in the hot sun in the harvest field. And so that speaks of the ministry and the ministers, profitable servants. Now, the ox is used to represent Christ in many places in the Bible. He was that strong in God, in his Father, patient, worked long and hard in the harvest field, had no place to lay his head for his Father. He was a faithful and true servant. Also, the ox is sometimes used to represent the nation of Israel. That is, when they were somewhat faithful in their ministry for the Lord, represented Israel, and in the end of time. And, of course, the ox represents ministers to. Remember, Paul says, don't muzzle the ox that treads out the corn. He picked up one of the laws from the Pentateuch and used it to say, the workman is worthy of his hire. Support the ministers in their ministry. But sometimes the ox is used of enemies, too, because the devil has those that are faithful and strong in him to minister for him all day long. So sometimes it represents enemies as well. All right, then the face that was in the rear from Ezekiel was that of the eagle. The eagle, of course, is very sharp-sighted. That bird can fly hundreds of feet above the earth and can spot a little tiny movement down there in this huge field with all of the rocks, and everything's the same color, just brown. Everything is brown, and the field mouse is brown. And he's tiny, and the eagle's on the move hundreds of feet above, and wind blowing in his eyes and everything, and he can look down and spot this little tiny field mouse just running around down there and swoop right down and have such good eyesight and timing to be able to swoop right down while this thing's on the run, anticipate the moves he's going to make, and snatch it up and take it up into the sky. So sharp-sighted, flies high, higher than many of the other birds. Swift, that's how it's able to catch, that's why it can be a bird of prey, to catch other birds or to catch small animals. It's swift. And I think the idea of being fearless would be involved in that as well. Now, this is said of God in the Bible. He is likened to an eagle. The saints are, of course, likened to eagles, where it says, they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. The enemies of God are sometimes likened to eagles. Now, some feel that almost whenever you see eagle in the Bible, it's actually referring to a vulture, because at least the bald eagle and the golden eagle were not indigenous to the Middle East, and that the vulture, which is another bird of prey, not unlike the eagle, was the one that was referred to there. But there may have been species of eagles there as well. If I remember right, there were some hawks at least. Now, this is so the enemies of God are sometimes, was the point I was making here, likened to eagles because predatory, swooping down on their poor helpless prey and carrying them away. Also, the king of Babylon is likened to an eagle, and the king of Egypt is likened to an eagle in the Bible. Now, when you pop your commentaries open on this verse, you'll see a veritable myriad of interpretations for these four, because they know they must be something. You know, what do these represent? Man, the ox, the eagle, the lion. And so I'm going to give you a number of composites here. What this one says these four are, and then what this one says the four are, and so forth. I'm not going to tell you who says what. I didn't put all the names down, but except for the first one here, and this is in Wordsworth's commentary. But he says it refers to the four aspects of Christ, to which I would agree, except I would take it one step further, the four aspects of Christ in us. Because Paul said it's Christ in the mystery of God is Christ in you, the hope of glory. The man, he didn't actually say represented anything. He just said, okay, there's the man. Then he said, maybe he's just saying the humanity of Christ. Then for the lion, he said that represented Christ as our king. And the ox, so I don't know how you want to do this in your notes for expedience sake, if you want to make four columns or what, whatever's easiest for you. Because I'm going to give you about, five or six of these, I think. Maybe more, seven or eight. The ox represents Christ as our sacrifice. And that's a good point, because the oxen or bullock was a sacrificial animal in the Levitical code. In fact, it was the most expensive of all. And then he said that the eagle represented Christ as our resurrection and life. And I think that's a good point, because the eagle mounts up and it flies way above the earth. And so Christ ascended up on high, led captivity captive. He's our resurrection and life. Now, another one said that the man represents the spirituality and wisdom of God. The spirituality and wisdom of God. And that's a good point. Men have wisdom and men have a spirit that animals don't have, and therefore there is a spirituality in man that animals don't have. And remember now, I'm not going to stop to make all the applications, but realize what this is talking about now in the fulfillment in the bride of Christ. The lion, he said, represents the majesty of the sovereign and judge. The majesty of the sovereign and judge. The ox is the creative, generative power of God. The creative, generative power of God. And the eagle, representing divine omnipresence, meaning everywhere present, and the eagle flies fast enough, the poor little rodents probably think they're ubiquitous, and divine omniscience, which means all-knowing, you know, and that's that sight, you know, that far-sightedness of the eagle. Now, of course, you'd have to modify these a little bit to move them right over to the bride of Christ. We're not going to be everywhere present, we're not going to be all-knowing. But when God gets through with this, we're going to know a lot more than we do now. And we're going to be able to have a lot more effectiveness as if we were present, more than we are now. The next one shows man as the goodness of God. And I think that's a good point, because man has the ability to show mercy, doesn't he? Even towards the animals or toward one another. He can stop and help someone that's in need and bind up their wounds and, you know, show mercy upon them. Animals don't really have that capacity. The lion would show the wrath and the justice of God. God's wrath and justice. The ox could show God's patience and his long-suffering. And the eagle could show God's swiftness to do good. God's swiftness to do good. Now remember, I took these down pretty much as I found them in the commentator. So when I say God's swiftness to do good, you could also interpret it to mean the saints being quick to do good. The next one would show man showing the attributes of gentleness and love. Animals don't really love. They might mate and reproduce after their kind, but it's not out of love. It's out of instinct. They do have certain soulical feelings to an extent. They can show care and so forth, but not to the extent that man can. Not really that love. The lion representing generosity and strength. I don't know where he picked up generosity for the lion, unless he was thinking, well, for the cubs, you know, they'll go out and get the prey and then they'll drag it home to the cubs and they're generous and so forth. Perhaps that's where he got that from. Strength, certainly you could see that. Lions are powerfully muscled animals, and they can just rip animals to shreds. The ox, he had the idea of constancy and firmness. Constancy and firmness. In other words, constant, not intermittent. Remember how the Bible says don't yoke an ox with an ass? That's one of the reasons why, because the ox is constant. He'll keep plodding right along. Maybe a slow pace, but he won't stop. He just keeps on keeping on. And the ass, he'll go real fast. He'll get frustrated with the ox, and he'll want to go real fast for a while, and then he'll want to stop and rest. And the ox just keeps on going. It's like the turtle and the hare, you know, tortoise and the hare. And so that idea of constancy and firmness. Then the eagle, he says, represents the vigor and heavenly nature, strength and heavenly nature, because he soars up into the heavens. Here's another set. The man shows being the head of creation. Man as the head of creation. We are to have dominion over the other of creation. The lion representing the king of the beasts. The ox representing the chief of the domestic animals. You know, domestic animals, those that are domesticated, used by man for farming and pets. And the eagle being the greatest of the birds, greatest in the air. I think what he was doing was this. He was saying every one of these is the greatest of his category. Man is the head of all creation. The lion is said to be the king of the beast. The ox is the chief of all the domestic animals. And the eagle is the greatest bird. So I think whatever his truth he was getting at, he was showing each one of these is the head of a certain category. And I could get a type out of that one too. And it's not as hard as getting blood out of a turnip either. But that is that this group is going to be the cream of the crop. They're going to be the best of the category. They're going to be the best of every category, whether it's the creative power of God coming forth, whether it's the strength, king of the beasts, the lion, whether it's the chief of the domestic animals, you know, the ministry, whether it's the greatest of the birds soaring up in the heavenlies. These are going to be those that are the chief of all the saints, the bride of Christ. The next one, this man said, they all typify Christ. The first one shows him to be a man, and the lion shows him to be from Judah, the lion of the tribe of Judah. And the next one shows him to be our sacrifice and minister, the ox. And the next one shows him to be the eagle, in the sense that he knew how to soar in the spirit with God. And the eagle is also noted for protecting assiduously his young. And remember how Christ did compare himself to a bird one time when he said, how oft I would have gathered thee to myself as a hen doth her brood, but you would not. Soaring in the spirit, protecting your young. Now here's another possibility. And I don't know if we got this from a commentator or if this was I came up with it or Don or whatever. Or a combination thereof. But this is the possibility that these four faces, man, lion, ox, and eagle, represent the four leading tribes of Israel. The four chief of the 12 tribes of Israel. And you say, well, what are the four chief tribes? Well, one way to figure that out would be when they camped around the tabernacle, three to a side. Remember, there are four sides to the tabernacle. In each group of three tribes, one was always said to be the chief of those three. One was said to lead out first when that group of three took off, when they would march through the wilderness. And those four tribes are, because he tells you in the historical books, or in the Numbers and Exodus, Reuben on the south side of the tabernacle. So if we draw a square here to represent the tabernacle, and on our map, this is north, On the south side, you would have the tribe of Reuben as the chief tribe, and then under him, you had the tribes of Simeon and Gad. And Reuben's standard, now, these standards are not based on the Bible. You cannot prove what the standards are. The Bible only says they had standards, but it doesn't say what they were. In other words, a flag with some kind of an emblem. You know, they must have some kind of a logo, some kind of an emblem that represents their tribe that they can rally around. I suppose it could have been colors, but most likely it was something emblazoned on the... So tradition says, then, that the standard of Reuben was a man. So then looking, that means you'd be looking north. And you see the face of a man, because Reuben is on the south. And, of course, we're always supposed to be looking north, towards the presence of God, toward heaven, as it were. So Reuben, standard is a man. Then on the east, let's see, this would be east over here, the head tribe was Judah. And under Judah were Zebulun and Issachar. And it has been said that Judah's standard was a lion. And that may be why Jesus was called the Lion of the tribe of Judah. He is that standard. He is that logo. He is that antitype that was represented by the lion. With that, you might put as a possible cross-reference, Genesis 49 and verse 9, Jacob's farewell blessing upon Judah, and Revelation 5:5. All right, looking on the west, opposite of Judah, you know Judah would be on the east. That's the presence of God. The sun rises in the east, and Judah is the tribe from which Jesus came, and he is the way to God. On the west, the lead tribe was Ephraim, and under him were Manasseh and Benjamin. And Ephraim's symbol was said to have been that of an ox. Okay? And then on the north, the lead tribe was the tribe of Dan. And under him were Asher and Naphtali. And Dan's logo was said to have been that of an eagle. Now, actually here, I can't be dogmatic. I don't recall, and I didn't put this in my notes, I can't recall if there are actually traditions for Judah, for Ephraim to have been ox and Dan to have been represented by the eagle. I know that there are traditions that Reuben was represented by a man, his standard, and Judah by a lion, but these last two I can't say, or whether that's just by way of extrapolation now, knowing that we've got two of the animals, who the other two, or two of the faces, what the other two would be. I think it is tradition on those two as well. Ephraim on the west is interesting. If you remember Jacob's blessing on Ephraim and Manasseh, and Manasseh would be great, but Ephraim would be greater, and how it can be fulfilled in the gospel going to the west, much greater than it has to the east. And so Ephraim is on the west side. Have I got this right now? Did I do this right? Yeah, this is the west. I saw the E for Ephraim and it made me think east. It's on the west of the tabernacle. Now, Dan might have been able to be on the chief on the north because he was the firstborn of the handmaid Bilhah, and Bilhah was Rachel's handmaid. So Dan was reckoned to Rachel, even though he was born naturally to Bilhah. By the way, tradition has assigned colors to the three of these anyway, too. Tradition has assigned the color of green to Judah, the lion, the color of gold to Ephraim, the ox, and the colors of red and white to Dan, the eagle. And I haven't seen a color represented for Reuben. So, maybe there's a parallel here. Here is the cherubim. Here is the tribes of Israel. Here is the kingdom of God. And in the center of the tabernacle, as you that have taken tabernacle class know, Aaron and Moses and the Levites lived. The Levites didn't have a landed inheritance, so you don't see Levi out here in the outer circle. They're in the inner circle. And so maybe they would represent, if we take this whole thing to be analogous to the cherubim, that very brightness, that very fire that was inside that cloud, that very spirit that was in the cherubim, possibly anyway. Now, again, there was some question as to which way the men's faces pointed in the four living creatures, whether they all pointed one direction or they all pointed outward towards four different directions. So you could just diagram it either way. This is going to be north. So here's one way, north. So if you're looking at it from the south, it would be all of the man's faces towards you. And then the other way is the way that you've got it on your outline there, with the man's faces always facing on the outward. And when Don taught the class, the way he stated it, I interpreted his statement to be this way, the way I've drawn it on the board. But when you see this handout, it looks like he's taking it the other way, if he was doing this handout, because it's got him facing outward. So I'm not real sure where he stands on that right now. So Israel was divided up into four camps, but it's still one people. It's one man that is seen, as it were. The four cherubim then are called the one living being. We are many saints universally, but we make up one body of Christ. Here's a couple others here, just throw in for good measure. Did the last bell ring?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll throw them out for good measure. We'll pick them up next week. Did I go over the bell? Oh, I am sorry. I apologize.
Okay.
Plus, the tape stops pretty much right after the last bell rings these days, and I don't want to go off the tape, and then the tape students don't get those remarks. So if I do the same thing again next week, please take the liberty to say that, remind me that the bell rang, or tell me that we can stop.